Well, Chase, have you ever been on a ship before?
I have never been on a ship before.
What's the biggest ship you've ever been on?
18-foot Lund. Actually, that's a lie. I've been on a yacht that was like 32 feet or something like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I think the biggest. Well, I was on a Carnival cruise once, so that was a big ship. But today we're talking about a big ship, 138 meters long,
An icebreaker.
an icebreaker, Class 1B icebreaker. And we got a guest today, or
Who's
actually,
on that ship?
who was on that ship, and we're actually at her house, so she's having us over, and her name's Jessica. And basically, we have her out here today to talk about a few things. She went on a trip to the north and was on this ship and learned a bunch of stuff that we thought we'd talk to her and figure it out. So, welcome to our show, Jessica.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah. I mean, you just weren't on a ship. You didn't just hop on a ship and go cruising around the Arctic. What kind of program was this that you were involved in?
So my involvement with the ship was that I got a Teachers on Ice scholarship. It was the first year that they were running it. It's through the Students on Ice Foundation, which has been taking students and different educators and elders on expeditions for the last 18 years
Oh,
with the
wow.
purpose of increasing awareness of what's happening in the North and how that is an indication of what's happening throughout the world. So yeah, I was lucky. This is the first year that they did the Teachers on Ice scholarship, and they had five teachers from across Canada, and I was lucky enough to be one of them.
From Portage and La Prairie, Manitoba.
Yeah.
That's
So,
awesome.
where are the other teachers from Canada, like all over kind of thing, or?
Yeah, they were kind of spread out. There was another one from Saskatoon, one from Ontario, one from Nova Scotia, and one from Yellowknife.
Nice.
Cool.
So that application, so you saw it wherever, and was it a process to get your information in and selection wise? Like, did you have to do interviews or how did that work?
Yeah, I actually saw it on Facebook.
Oh,
My
yeah.
sister-in-law tagged me. Kelly tagged me.
Oh, yeah.
So thanks, Kelly. And I just looked at it and thought, oh, that'd be cool. That'd be really cool. They had like a picture of people walking across a glacier, and didn't really think anything of it. Just thought that would be a really neat experience and didn't really see myself doing that. Kept scrolling, put my phone away, and then that night I was just kind of laying in bed thinking, you know what? Why not?
Yeah.
Like, I was super busy at the time when the applications were due, so that's why I think I didn't even put myself in that place to think that I could do that. But when I was laying there thinking, well, all of this busyness will be over. It'll be summer. I have 2 months off. I'm a teacher,
Yeah.
so why not? I can do that.
Yeah.
And decided to get started on the application. And it was actually pretty intense. Like, even my job, my professional career, didn't have as many steps to go through before I got that.
Yeah.
So it was like a big online form, and then I needed my cover letter, resume, a bunch of information about my school and my principal. I needed two reference letters, and I had to submit a video answering a bunch of essay questions, and then some written essay questions as well. So
Holy moly.
yeah, at that time I didn't even have internet at home, so I was like using my data on my phone trying to make this video and trying to send it in. I think I had like 20 minutes left to send it, waiting for it to slowly, that little line to slowly load. It was nerve-wracking, actually.
Yeah, for sure.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so then there's a big obvious process to get there, or get your application, and then getting there, you guys all met in Ottawa, right?
Yeah, so we met in Ottawa for the first couple days of the expedition. There were only 12 days that we were on the boat, but or on the ship. Oops, I can't say boat. It's not a boat. It's a ship. Yeah, so there were 12 days that we were on the ship, but the first couple days we were in Ottawa, and they did an amazing job. You could tell it wasn't their first rodeo.
Yeah.
They had a great registration process. They had Mike, actually also from Manitoba, waiting at the airport, and he's such a wonderful person to do that. So exciting. And we all met and got settled, and then started with just different activities. So we had activities. We stayed at Carleton University and had activities for like the students to get to know each other and staff to get to know the students and everything. We went ziplining. We went and saw the Museum of Nature.
Nice.
And yeah, it was amazing.
I mean, not to have a silly pun, but that'd be a great way to break the ice between a lot of people, right? And there's probably a lot of different like cultures there, right? Like different ethnic groups of people. And was there, I mean, just out of Canada, so there's five, but how many people do you know, like a number of what was on there, like coming to do this thing?
Well, there were, this was the most diverse group that they've ever had, they were saying. Right. They were able to do that because they have a larger ship, but there were people from 19 different countries. There was 127 oh, wow. students and 98 educational staff.
Right. Wow. So you would fit in that educational staff
yeah.
group? Okay. Right on. So then going into this, you're in Ottawa. What was your, like, personally, you hunt and fish, you're outdoors all the time. Do you have any like personal goals for doing this? Like, what were you trying to get out of it, like on a personal level and on a professional level?
Well, I think that kind of plays to it. I was able to get things not only for my classroom, which was the goal of it,
right,
but also on a personal level. So just seeing the different ways of life in the north was amazing for me. There were elders that they had from northern communities on the ship, and just to be able to talk with them about their life practices, and the students too, they were such a breadth of knowledge, sharing with me what their cultural practices were and how they hunted and what they hunted and what they used from each thing that they hunted was amazing. I remember sitting at dinner one day with one of the students, and I was just asking her about, she had just made some mukluks and she had made a jacket. And it was her school project, and she was super excited. And then she was sharing with me some recipes that how they prepared their caribou.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm sitting there frantically, like, on my phone in the notes, like, okay, and then what do you do? What do you do next? I'm going to try this.
Right.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So, like, you guys got on the ship in Ottawa? Is that right?
No, we didn't, actually. We flew. So, in Ottawa, they chartered two flights, actually, because there were so many of us. So we hopped on there. We stopped in Iqaluit for gas. And then we continued on to Kangerlussuaq in Greenland.
Oh,
so
wow.
That's where we got off the plane. Took a little boat. Or no, we didn't take a boat ride. We took a bus ride to the port. And then that's where we hopped on the Zodiacs to get on the ship.
Holy.
Awesome.
So it was a little bit of a process.
Yeah. Planes, trains, and automobiles.
No
yeah,
kidding.
So then for your guys' big group, what was their goal? Like, what, there's probably, you know, certain things they wanted to touch on. What were they, like, what was their goals basically at the end of the day?
Yeah. So they have a variety. There were four areas of knowledge that they were hoping everyone would get. So they were climate change, oceanic literacy, sustainable development goals, and truth and reconciliation. So those were the four main things. And they did that through different ways, like academic sessions. And then most of it, they tried to make sure that we understood is flexible, right? So through authentic learning, through those conversations, through digging a little deeper with the people that are on the ship with you, because you're on the ship for 12 days. So it's only so big. Even though it's pretty big, it's only so big. And when you have that many people together, you're going to spend a lot of time with each other. So
right.
You get to know everyone's true colors come out, and you get to know everyone's what they do in their life and what they're about.
That's cool. That's a lot of, I mean, having the diversity on the boat too and being in that situation is probably pretty neat to get to know people and putting them in that situation and getting their outlook on the situation, stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
So how many communities did you guys travel to on the ship? Do you know?
Well, the amount that we were supposed to go to is different than what we actually did end up going to, because like they kept saying, flexibility is key when you're on those expeditions, right. And we definitely learned that. Jeff Green is the expedition leader, so he's been running it and organizing it since its conception, and he said it was the first time that we started and ended in the same spot, because just conditions of ice and mm-hmm. and different things that didn't allow us to keep with the original plan. So I'm not sure exactly how many that we stopped in. We were in Kangerlussuaq twice. So that's in Greenland. 5 or 6, I would say.
Nice.
Times we get to go into a community. We disembarked the ship 10 times. So that includes just going for like a Zodiac cruises or a Zodiac landing. So that's where you're in a community or at a different site.
Right.
So of the 10, those only 3 of them were planned though. So that just kind of shows how much it changed throughout the trip, how much the plans changed.
Right. Yeah, no kidding. So out of those 4 goals and all your trips into the land and everything, I guess one of the biggest topics in Canada and what we kind of want to talk about is the climate change part of it. Is there anything you want to touch on that before we dive right into climate change?
Yeah, definitely. There's so much to say as far as that goes. That was definitely one of the things that I saw a lot of people on the ship, their eyes kind of, not open, but open a little wider.
Yeah.
We were lucky enough to have a researcher on the ship from New York who she has dedicated her life to climate change research. And she was an amazing addition to the expedition. So there were a couple of things that I was surprised about. One of them, she was talking about how much the sea level was rising, and that's a huge concern for us. Maybe living inland, we don't really see it as much.
Right.
But communities that live really close, we had actually 2 students that were from Malaysia as part of a some kind of exchange program, and that would greatly affect them. So that directly affects their life. So they were extremely surprised, or not surprised, but it hit them. They took it to heart. So she was saying that previously the sea levels would rise like by the near the last ice age, they would be rising like 4 meters per century. Right now what they're rising is 30 meters per century.
Wow.
And just which is crazy, right? That's a huge difference.
Yeah.
She had so many other things to share with us, but one of the big things that was very evident throughout our whole journey was that there was so much ice in the water.
Yeah.
And you might think, oh, isn't that good? There's lots of ice. You couldn't get into all these places because there was lots of ice. But the reason that there's so much of that ice in the water, it's not because it's frozen on the water. That's ice that was originally from the glaciers that has been calving. So that's when they break off and you get icebergs, right, that go into the water. So there was tons of ice in the water because the glaciers were calving that much more.
Crazy. So that's, I mean, like you mentioned earlier, like we might not see or feel the effects of climate change directly. Some of the things that we might see around here, just some hotter summer days, some more forest fires that have been happening, especially this year, is quite noticeable. I mean, they do have good years and bad years too, but the Arctic is obviously the first kind of ecosystem to get affected by climate change. And it's, I mean, quite important, obviously, why you guys were up there looking at stuff. And like you said about the glaciers and stuff like that. And if you look at the, like the polar ice cap maps and stuff and how they've been receding more and more every year, I mean, it's quite evident of what's happening. One of the things that probably the best description I've heard of that simplifies an ecosystem, it was kind of referenced to a bicycle wheel, right? And as the ecosystem kind of declines, you start losing animals or habitat and stuff like that. And each animal and habitat represents a spoke on that bicycle, right? On that wheel. So as you start losing them, it gets weaker, and then eventually it's just so weak that it can't maintain, right? So when that happens, I mean, what's happening now is that starting in the Arctic, I believe, and then it's eventually all going to come back home to us at some point.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Another one that I hadn't heard before, but it's a great way, is someone had mentioned the reason that we're in the Arctic is because it's kind of like a coal in a canary.
Canary in a coal mine.
Oh, jeez. As soon as I said that, I'm like, wait, that's the candle. No, that's, yeah, I'm thinking of the candles, that business. Canary in a coal mine. So there, even though, like you said, we might be seeing the effects everywhere else as well, just in different ways, it's super evident in the Arctic. Their ecosystem is very, very vulnerable.
Right.
One of the... So we'll see changes in things like when we have changes in the climate here in the prairies, for example, we're going to see changes in our weather patterns as well, like you had said. So different wildfires and all of that, and just it's changing. The weather is different, whereas before it wouldn't have necessarily been. There they're seeing changes in ice amounts and types of ice. One of the elders was explaining that they don't want to teach their young hunters the traditional ways of hunting because of not only hunting, but the traditional ways of seeing and reading the ice because it's different now.
Yeah.
And this is information that they've had passed on through generations and that they were able to follow like a map. And now they can't, all of a sudden so quickly, can't share that with their grandchildren, with their children, because they don't want to share some information about how to read ice conditions and then have them go out onto the ice and fall through and die.
Right.
Yeah, so that's affecting a way of life for these people up north right now, mm-hmm. right?
I guess like it, when it is changing, just like you said, for the elders teaching, it's a big safety thing. Did they mention anything about their hunting traditions, about how it's been changing? Maybe with like migration of animals or birds or... even the fishing, like they're big fishermen up there, right? So have they mention anything around that aspect of the changing ice and everything else?
Yeah, there were definitely lots of things mentioned. We were lucky because we had people from all over the north. So we had a chance to see how everybody was experiencing it differently. There are some of the women there that were sharing that they had to go to different places to find caribou that were herds of thousands that would just walk right past their homes and communities previously, or when they were a little bit, even not too much younger, but a little bit younger, they would just sit and watch all the thousands of caribou pass right by them. And now the herds are maybe 100.
Oh yeah.
Or they're much smaller, the groups are much smaller. A lot of people were talking about how the ice is different, and a lot of people went through the ice a while ago when all of this first started to become super evident. Now they've kind of adapted to know when you can and can't go on and off the ice.
Yeah.
But it really affects their life. Like they rely on hunting and sustaining themselves. So when there's a couple extra weeks at the start and a couple extra weeks at the end of the season, that's a whole month of the year that they can't be hunting or that they can't be going out onto the water to go fishing or whatever. So that really greatly affects them.
Yeah. So I guess by you being there firsthand, was there, like, could you see that kind of struggle of them just adapting to the new ways other than them telling you about it? Like, did you experience like getting in some of those communities and just, you know, just like the vibe that was set off by those communities that things are getting harder to adapt and live up there?
Yeah, when we were anchored just outside of Pond Inlet in Canada, when we first got there, we were supposed to bring some elders and some Parks Canada staff on board with us, and there were a couple people that needed to disembark, and the ice was so bad that we did get everyone on and off.
Yeah.
But we had difficulty because so that we use Zodiacs to get into communities or to leave the ship, and they get loaded up with a big crane on top of the ship. So while they were waiting to load all of the Zodiacs, one of them ended up getting pushed out super far away within a very quick amount of time. So that was just an, and they actually needed to turn the ship to go, in a sense, rescue him. And so that just kind of showed how dangerous it can be being out when there's ice.
Oh, yeah, it got pushed out by a piece of ice.
Yeah, so there was lots of like smaller icebergs. And the current was going one way and the wind was pushing another, and he was in a Zodiac alone, so there wasn't a ton of weight.
Right.
And so, yeah, he just got sucked out away from the ship. He was right at the ship at the stern, kind of where there wasn't a lot of ice, but just kept getting pushed farther and farther out. And we had some students that were from Pond, and we also had all the elders and the Parks Canada staff that were with us. And yeah, I was talking with one of the students, and they just kind of said that, yeah, it's like if you need to get out of the community and the ice is pushed in, then you just kind of have to wait.
Yeah.
Or you have to be prepared to be outside for hours longer than you intended.
Right.
Or days. I didn't realize, I guess if I thought about it a little bit more, I would have realized that how much the ice conditions are affected by wind. It's obvious. Like, we see it here with
the big lakes,
Lake Manitoba, like Winnipeg. You get a wind coming from one direction for a couple days, and it increases the water level. And I totally could have realized that thinking about the ice in the north, but it just never occurred to me.
Right. Just to back up just a little bit, just for anybody that's listening too. So a Zodiac is like, what is it, 16 foot inflatable with a hard bottom boat?
Yeah.
And then it's got a smaller motor. So that's what you'd use to basically taxi from the ship into inland.
Yeah.
That's the only way to really do it, right? Because there's no big ports there. There's no nothing really, right?
No, a lot of our landings were wet landings. So you're just pulling up onto a beach. You needed rubber boots. But some of them, we were lucky. There were some docks some places. But
oh, yeah. So I guess when we're sticking on the climate change thing, you said you did like a bunch of trying out different foods, stuff like that. What was some meals that you had that you maybe couldn't get in Portage la Prairie?
There were lots of things that we were able to try. The community members and all the Inuit from the north were super excited to share with us what their traditional foods were. So I got to try, the word's escaping me right now. But anyway, we got to try it's like narwhal jerky.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So it was like, we make jerky here, or we don't make it. My uncle makes it. And, it reminded me of that. It wasn't much different.
Really?
It just, they didn't have seasoning on it. So, I tried it and everyone's looking at me like, oh, what does she think of it? And I'm like, this is like jerky without seasoning. That's what it reminds me of. It was good.
That's cool.
And then we also got to try it like sushi raw.
Oh yeah.
And it was so good. Maybe my favorite of any type of wild game I've ever had. It was so good.
What kind of good? Like, was it the texture and the flavor? Or?
It was, yeah, the texture. The flavor was really subdued. Like, it wasn't very strong.
Right.
And the texture, I think it was the texture. I think I really liked the texture. Have you guys ever tried, like, tapioca balls and, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it kind of reminded me of that. Which it was not what I expected, but a little bit harder. And so it was kind of chewy. They were saying sometimes people just like put it in their mouth, like instead of gum, and just chew on it. Yeah, it was not expected though. So I don't know if it was just because I was super excited. But yeah, I really liked that. We also got to try char. So there was always a group whenever we did a landing that was fishing. And so I mostly hung out there. And or I tried to, especially nearing the end, I wanted to catch a char.
Yeah.
The elusive char, I never got one.
Oh, no.
It's like they knew I wanted one so bad that they're like, I'm not gonna bite her hook. we tried some char sushi, so it was really good also.
Nice.
It was a nice Same thing as the narwhal. The flavor wasn't too strong. So I tried that. And then one of the ladies also on the last day, she pulled out one of the fins and said, try this. Like, do you guys, when you have walleye, do you take the bunny ears?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bunny ears.
I've heard of them as bunny ears. You don't call them bunny ears? We call them bunny ears. But it tasted exactly like that.
Oh, yeah.
And that's maybe, that and the cheeks are maybe my favorite part.
Right.
And so I got super excited. I didn't, just pulled it out raw. Here you go. Eat this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was really good. What else did we have? So we had that as sushi. So we had that raw. And then we also had that boiled. And then it was super good because we did a polar dip. So we like ran in our bathing suits and came out, and the water was 3 degrees. And one of the one of the freshwater experts was taking he was taking readings of how cold it was. And as soon as I got out, he said, "Yeah, well, it's, you're lucky we went in here. It's warmer here. It's 3 degrees. Where we were before, it was 1.6 or something. 3 degrees is still cold."
Yeah.
As he didn't go in, he's still wearing his jacket and everything, his toque.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was really awesome to have the char broth as soon as we got out.
So that would just be like a soup kind of
idea? It was just like a soup. It was just like a really salty broth.
Yeah, it's nice. It's char. It's nice and it's a rich kind of fish too. It's lots of fat in that, and it's, that'd be pretty tasty after a polar plunge, that's for sure.
Yeah, it was perfect. Warm me up. The other thing that was neat was the first landing that we did, still in Greenland, so that was in Canada, and then when we were in Greenland, the first landing we found a bunch of mussels. We were able to eat those, like move the kelp, grab a mussel, crack it open. But they're really hard to crack open, especially when your hands are like freezing. I have trouble with my hands and feet getting cold. And so I'm like standing there shaking for like 10 minutes trying to open one mussel. And then all of these ladies that are used to this are just going and they're like opening one in, like it's nothing. And so finally someone, they were trying to help me and it didn't work. And then finally someone helped me and I understood like the way that she did it, I was able to do it that way. And I was watching her do hers, and she was scraping off these white organisms. I don't know exactly what they would have been. And I asked her, like, why are you scraping those off? Because previously someone had said, oh, take those off or they'll bite you. And I was thinking, I don't know, what are you talking about, they'll bite you? And she said, oh, we eat these. Do you want to know how we eat these? And of course I did, right?
Yeah.
I want to know how you eat those. And she goes, find me a rock. I'm like, okay, well, there's this, everything's rocks. Like, what kind of rock do you want? So she found a perfect rock that fit like in the palm of her hand, and it had kind of like a flat end. So it was like a perfect little hammer. And then we had to find a clump of them that looked clean.
Yeah.
And there was a whole bunch around that she said there wasn't really any good spots, but she found one. And then she just started smashing the rock against them. So they sit on the rock, like they attach to the rock. So she was smashing them and making a paste. And she put her little hammer rock down and took the paste with her fingers. And then she put it to her mouth and just inhaled, basically.
Holy.
And I'm like, what is going on? And she had, because a lot of it's shell, so then she just like pulled it away from her mouth and just spit out all the shell and went, yeah, that's how you do it.
No way.
So I obviously tried it and it was super salty. Right, like on salt. The ocean, right? Yeah. So it was super salty. But she said, yeah, this is what people do and you won't be thirsty anymore if you do this.
Really?
So...
That's interesting. It's pretty sweet that you get to eat mussels and fresh like fish and shellfish, right? Like,
yeah.
It doesn't get any fresher than that. That's
and
awesome.
A little disclaimer for people, don't try that in Manitoba. Because the only reason we're able to do that is because the water stays cold enough that the bacteria won't accumulate.
Oh, yeah.
If you try that in Manitoba, even if it's when it's cold, there's still bacteria.
Yeah.
So please don't try that.
Good tip.
Very good tip.
Yeah.
So I guess when with all these foods and everything that you've tried, coming back home, and like we said earlier, you hunt and fish and shoot ducks and deer and everything. Do you think you took anything away from that on how you're going to field dress a deer, maybe looking for more things to take out of a deer than, you know, your regular, like, field dressing harvest kind of thing. Anything that you take away from being up north that maybe you should be, you know, looking at salvaging everything you can off an animal?
Definitely. There were, well, the one thing I was mentioning earlier, sitting at supper with the one girl, it was a dessert recipe. So she said, take the fat off the hindquarter of a caribou and mix it with berries. And I can't remember if caribou was the one you mix with oil or water. You just like put it in one of those blenders and put just a tiny bit of oil or water. I have it written down somewhere, but and then you throw like frozen or fresh blueberries. And she said it's just amazing. Like, the look in her eye, it's like she was craving it as soon as she said it. She was like, she wanted some. So I was sold. I'm like, Kate, Scotty, if you go up for a caribou, I probably won't be able to just because of, yeah, like I said, my hands freeze all the time. I would love to get a caribou, but yeah, in my work schedule. But I was like, Kate, save the fat on the hindquarter. I want to try that. But it was amazing because they use everything.
Yeah.
Absolutely everything. Inuit would save all of the fat from everywhere or from anything that they hunted and use it to burn.
Right.
Like as an oil to burn. To keep warm, obviously. There's not trees in the north.
Right.
Yeah.
So
can't burn rocks.
Yeah. Can't burn rocks. So that was another thing that I hadn't really thought about, but is super obvious.
Yeah.
So they were using everything. A lot of the communities we went to that were whaling communities, they were using the bones of the whales. You could see them throughout the community. So it's just a way of life to use absolutely everything, especially when you live in a place that, for us down south, it seems so desolate. Like, you look out and you don't see a bunch of trees. I don't know. From the south, I feel like sometimes people think if there's no trees, there's nothing. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that I was blown away by on our first landing, is it's not that there's less diversity. It's just that it's all smaller.
Yeah.
So we were looking, I went with the botany crew that day, and I was actually blown away by how much diversity there was in the plants. They had willow trees. And yeah. I didn't believe it at first. I'm like, this is not a tree. And they just grow like a couple inches tall. They grow out, not up.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
just yeah. Because of the shorter growing season and exposure. So yeah. That was really neat to see that.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of diversity on the, like, on the tundra and stuff like that. I know, like, for the amount of time that I've spent out there, it's incredible. Like, there's a short window because obviously the growing season is so short up there, but if you hit that window correctly, the amount of stuff that you could collect, like plants and berries and stuff, like I know areas that I've been to, there's, you land somewhere and there's like a field of like cranberries or blueberries, and there's gooseberries and cloudberries and all these different plants and stuff like that. And it's really cool at for a week or two in September when they start transitioning into fall, all those plants turn a different color, and it's amazing how colorful the landscape gets.
Yeah.
Just very vibrant, like reds, blues and oranges and yellows, and it's crazy. It's obviously a little bit different where you were at, and but I'm sure it'd be very similar to that, having that diversity in the plant life, like you said.
Yeah, it was totally like that. I had no idea how many different types of plants and how beautiful the plants were.
Yeah.
We didn't get to see a ton of the berries, but the last day, the groups got split up because we were obviously such a huge amount of people. Half of us went on the ice cap tour in Greenland. So we went and got to stand on the second largest ice cap, and the other group went for a hike, and they were pretty pumped because they got to pick berries and eat them. And nice. I asked, oh, did anyone save any for any of us? No.
Why would we?
Yeah. Yeah. So that was really neat. Actually, one of the things that I forgot to mention when you guys were asking me about climate change that was very obvious was just the decline and how much the glaciers were calving. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of ice that was previously on the land that's now in the water and going and melting. Another thing that I never thought of that I learned while we were there was that not only do ice caps keep the water or keep the ice out of the water, so they don't increase the, or how am I trying, what am I trying to say here? They don't increase the water level when there's ice, more ice on the land.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But they also keep the water level lower because they're so massive that they have their own gravitational pull.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't know that. So not only is it that there's less water in the ocean, which isn't really a huge component into the rising sea level concern, it's mostly about the gravitational effect. So at both of the poles, there's more water there.
Right.
Then there would be more towards the equator and where the majority of people live.
Cool.
So the smaller that they get, one, the more ice and water there is in the ocean. But
right.
The most important thing is that there is less of a gravitational pull. So more right. of that water is going to start to move towards...
Disperse, yeah.
Yeah.
So when it comes to those glaciers and ice and stuff like that, and maybe you didn't look at this kind of information or maybe it wasn't brought to your attention, but is it every single year they're shrinking, or is there ever any growth in them?
There is still growth in different ones. The first place that we had a Zodiac cruise, that I wish I remembered the numbers. We were in the Zodiacs though, and it was really cold that day, so I wasn't gonna have my little notebook out. But our Zodiac driver was super amazing. He was sharing tons of facts with us. And the glacier that we visited on that first day, every year it's receding in total. So in the summer it recedes, and then in the winter it grows a little bit, but the amount that it's receding is a crazy difference. I want to say this, but I don't know if it's true. I think he said it's receding 17 meters. At the end of the year, the total, it's receding 17 meters. So that accounts for the growth and
right.
The summer.
Yeah, and the loss of the sea ice, right? I think one thing that's important about the glaciers, too, and the ice caps is, like, not just the water levels that it affects. It affects a lot of wildlife also. Work that I've done in the past with polar bear biologists and stuff like that, lots of those animals kind of count on that ice cap because there's a almost like a shelf in the sea where the sea life kind of lives. But it's not just lives, but like there's a area there where it thrives, and it's deep enough and shallow enough where that's where that sea life, the most of the sea life thrives, and that's where the bears like to be, because that's where the seals are going to be.
That's where they hunt.
Yeah, and that's where they hunt. And as that polar ice cap recedes, that they're no longer there. There's no hunting grounds for the bears. The bears can't really keep up with the seals in the water. And that's where the seals are going to be, because that's where the fish is and all that stuff. So
big circle.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a circle of life there. And that's how they get affected. And it's funny how you see the effects get kind of interpreted by different people. I know in Churchill, you know, it's when the bears have a bad year on ice where they don't have a long enough period where they can hunt and stuff like that, they tend to see more bears in the community, right? Because they are skinnier, they're getting hungry, and they're looking for something to eat. So we're talking a difference between like 2 weeks or to a month on the ice where they lose those good hunting grounds. So when they have a good year, like last year, you hardly see any bears in town because they're happy, they're content, they have enough energy to pull them through till the next hunting season. And just to give you an idea, those bears are losing about 25 pounds a week when they come to land. So you do the math on that. They come in about June, they get off the ice, and then they go back out late November, December, depending on when the freeze up is, right?
You say 25 pounds a month?
A week,
okay. Yeah.
Sorry, did I say a month?
I don't know. I just...
Yeah. So
a lot of information right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, so it's quite a bit. So you're looking at 100 pounds a month.
Right.
And over the period of, say, like June, July, August, September, October, November, you're looking at five or six months there, right? Mm-hmm. So
what is an average polar bear weigh anyways?
Depends on the, like a mature male adult in the Western Hudson Bay population, when he comes off of the ice, he's probably anywhere from 800 to 1200 pounds on the higher end.
Oh yeah.
Females a little bit smaller. They can be, they're 800 pounds on the high end, and then probably down to like 600 pounds for just coming off the ice.
So they're like losing like 40% of their weight.
Yeah,
by the time huge. They're returning to the ice.
Yeah, they just fast and they try and preserve as much energy as possible.
And that, they say that it's kind of like a hibernation for them is actually being on land, isn't it? Like they come to land and they just chill and everything slows down.
Yeah, so it's a little bit different than any other bears. Like that, polar bears don't really go into hibernation, but they're in kind of like a hibernative state in the summertime. Whereas like black bears and grizzly bears actually go into their den and they hibernate. Even right. the female polar bears are the only ones that when they have their cubs, when they're pregnant, they'll go into a den, but it's still a different hibernative state than the other bears.
A little bit different. To.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So,
yeah. That's one of the effects of climate change that's having on the ecosystem up there that I see. And, you know, you hear people say, oh, there's so many bears around now. You've never seen so many bears. And that's because they're getting hungrier and they're have to search for food and they're getting restless kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's where the biggest, argument is. You talk to some of the local people and they're like, oh no, there's lots of bears. There's no climate change. Well, it's because of climate change why there's so many bears, right?
Yeah.
It's obvious from what you just said.
Yeah.
When you were on your trip, Jessica, did you ever come across people that were skeptical of climate change? Like the locals were like, no, it's not that bad. Like it's fine.
On the trip, a lot of the people that were there that I was speaking to had been on the ship before.
Okay.
So they had seen and had heard what the scientists and heard what the other people had to say from different communities in the north. So they believed and could see it. Everyone that I talked to on the ship understood.
Right.
But a lot of people at home, like there was one question I had. And for me, from a science background, like when I went to university, I took my major is in biology and ecology.
Okay.
So this was nothing new for me. But I had a couple people, like one person said, so this climate change thing isn't made up. And I said, no, it's absolutely not. It's not even a question.
Right.
And I think... honestly, it's probably has to do with the ease of access of social media and people not believing and being able to spread their message that it's not true. And I feel like a lot of that narrative comes from places where you don't see the same type of effects. So there's some places in the world that we already discussed that will see the effects of climate change a lot faster than other places. And some places that you don't, or you don't maybe not necessarily recognize it.
Yeah.
Because it's not always that it's hotter.
Right.
Right. There's also other effects. So maybe there might be more wind or the wind patterns might be changing.
Right.
Or it's unpredictable weather. So a lot of those people think this isn't climate change. This is normal. It's a cycle. Well, that's true. It is a cycle. But the climate change part is that the cycle is speeding up at rates that we've never seen before. So what's happened in the last couple hundred years, and especially more lately in the last 50 years, is that we're seeing the changes that should have happened over 1,000 years
right.
or longer.
Right. So that's like, the world's obviously always changing. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But like you said, it's just how fast it's changing now is the issue.
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing is like the education and the proper education, I think, because there's like, obviously people are skeptical on certain aspects of climate change to the point where it used to be global warming when they changed it from global warming to climate change, because technically it wasn't global warming. Like, they've changed that narrative. Well, though, there.
It is global warming, but I think they changed it because, or they don't try to use that term as much because not every single place
is warming.
The weather isn't always warmer. Right, so right. There's always a difference between climate and weather. And I think that's sometimes where some people get confused. Like, weather is what happens day to day, and climate is the overriding what the temperature precipitation type of thing is. And so some people, their weather is not warmer, and so that gives a misconception that, well, the climate's not warming then if my weather isn't warmer.
Right. Yeah. And it's not just like warming that's being affected by this these changes, right? It is the climate, it's weather patterns, it's fires, it's, stuff like that. It's
tornadoes in the middle of Manitoba now.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, like, I wasn't here 35 years ago, but I don't know if there was tornadoes 35 years ago in Manitoba. Like, things are changing, and the patterns are changing to points where it's like, holy crap, like, what's going on here?
Right.
The other thing I was just going to mention too, maybe like on personal note or whatever, do you think that humans are leaving a big enough footprint on the world that we're making it change that much faster? And is there any way that, you know, with all the stuff that we're doing to like try to eliminate carbon and so on and so forth with emissions and so on and so forth, do you think there's anything that we could do as a population to actually slow this down? Like, or is that already, do you think it's too far gone? Like, it's just trying to control what we're doing now.
There's tons of things that we can do. And actually that plays perfectly into one of the other pillars, like areas of knowledge that was the goal of the trip.
Mm-hmm.
So the SDG goals, so sustainable development goals, were developed that came from the Paris Agreement. I should know more on dates and stuff like this, but that was an agreement where you had 196 countries signed, and the goal is to meet these 17 goals, to one of them being reduce climate change and poverty. There's a ton of I can't remember all the 17, but by 2030.
Okay.
And so how we accomplish those goals, how every different country accomplishes those goals, might be different, but there's a ton of things that we can do as individuals. So try and use less plastics. So basically, you know what, actually, instead of that, I'll just say, try and think of the amount of energy that it takes to create, to transport, and go into every single product that you're buying.
Mm.
So reducing our consumption. So like I said, plastic is a huge one because it takes a lot of energy and it's not a natural compound, so it doesn't break down very easily. And it can affect and disrupt lots of ecosystems, lots of the smaller parts of the ecosystem, right? So on a food chain, if you affect the smallest organism, that's going to affect all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
And we typically don't see it until you get to some of the higher levels of the food chain, but the lower levels are the ones that are the most vulnerable. Our amount of emissions is a huge one that we would be able to do. I know in Canada, a lot of people say, well, we're Canada, we don't use as much as some other places like the States and China. But like, China's the one that's producing a lot of the things that we consume.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, maybe China could be more efficient, but we're the ones that are...
They're using it.
Using
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
We're the ones that are...
driving that economy for them to build it, right?
Yeah, exactly. So... yeah, we can say these other countries need to reduce it so much more, but we can reduce our impact that we're making as well. And a lot of it will be on a personal level, but realistically, it needs to be at a higher level. So the different companies and organizations the different companies that are creating and using a ton of energy are the ones that we need to pressure to be able to reduce that, or to take more economic, or sorry, it might not be better economically, but environmentally it might be better. So we might have to pay more for certain products that are more sustainable.
Right.
But that's a choice that we have to make as individuals that will make a, that will create a bigger change.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, those are very valid points. Like one thing, when I was just thinking about it while you're talking about like the plastic consumption and stuff, it must be like really crazy for the, like the individuals up north, like the Inuit and stuff that don't use any of these plastics. They're like really sustainable on their own food, their own clothing. They like basically make everything. And it's affecting them the most. You know what I mean? Like, that's got to be, like, just the biggest shot ever.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's pretty terrible that, you know, this is happening. But I guess as a huge community, like, as a human population, we just got to do our own little thing to try to, I guess, slow it down now, right? Like, it's evident it's happening. The only thing we can do is slow it down, right? Like, slow down our consumptions and slow down whatever it is that we got to do. If it's recycling, carpooling, or whatever, I think every little bit that you do is going to help eventually.
Yeah, for sure. Go plant a tree even.
Yeah, I don't know. I used to be a tree planter.
Did you?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, in BC.
Oh.
I did it for a year.
I did not know summer. That.
Yeah. It was not fun. And I didn't make much money.
You obviously didn't plant many trees then.
No. Yeah, well, at the start, I was sucked really bad, and then at the end, I was planting anywhere between 2,500 to 3,000 trees a day.
Wow.
So an average of 10 cents a tree, you'd make $300. And at that time, I thought I was a millionaire, but it wasn't really much money.
Did you see any bears then?
Yeah, we had bears in our camp, and we've seen quite a few bears. And there's guys that had, like, a rifle or whatever in camp, and guys that would be out on our, like, tree planting blocks that, well, I think they'd bring a rifle every time, and
yeah. Like a bear monitor.
Yeah, it was pretty good. It was very safe. Like, there was no problems there.
Okay, I wanna kind of break off from the climate change just for a second, but I want to dig a little deeper into a topic that we were discussing prior to getting the record. Just a short touch on the this ice mapper dude, which I thought was pretty cool.
Ice mapper dude.
Yeah. So on the ship, you guys had an individual that it was his job to draw up these maps, or how did he do this? Was it a digitized system that he used? Oh, hang on. She's going to go grab some of these maps right now. No? Oh.
Okay, so we were lucky. Yeah, you're right. We had an ice specialist. His name was Donovan Tremblay. So he worked at the Canadian Ice Service. So he wasn't drawing up the maps there, but he was getting it from his colleagues. And we were super lucky to have him because he was the one that was able to read the ice maps as a professional. And not that the crew wasn't able to do that, but it was just another helper. And a big part of what they did was basically it ended up being, yeah, we can't go to this next place, or no, we can't go to, the biggest one was that the biggest decision was that we couldn't go to Resolute Bay, which was based on the itinerary of the trip. That was the, that was where we were supposed to officially disembark and hop on a plane to go back to Ottawa. So he was able to confirm that no, the ice was too bad and we wouldn't be able to do that. And we just kind of crossed our fingers and hoped that it would still, in one sense, stay so bad as to confirm that we were right and not going there.
Right.
And it actually was. So the day that we arrived in Kangerlussuaq for the second time, we still wouldn't have been able, we still would have been waiting outside of Resolute Bay, not able to actually get on land to get to the airport. So it was a good decision, and we were lucky that we had him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all of the other experience and expertise of our captain and crew, and Jeff Green, who was our leader there. So
that's cool. I think that's just one thing that you don't really think about when you're on an icebreaker, I guess. For me, I think, you know, up on the ship and away you go, icebreaker, and just plow through everything. But you actually have to, I guess, predict the patterns of the ice and stuff like that. And that's, I'm sure, another effect of climate change is, like, if not just your ship that you guys were on, but like other ships that are maybe bringing these community supplies and stuff like that, you know, can they get in there? What's their windows of opportunities and stuff like that too?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we saw other ships. We saw some mining ships, and we also saw some exactly supply ships. But yeah, they would be end up being waiting outside of a community or outside of the mine if there was too much ice. Mm-hmm. Can't get in. There's nothing you can do. You have to wait for the wind to move it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's crazy. I spent a bit of time with work up in Churchill. That's farthest north, I think. I've been to Rankin, I guess, and stuff, but. I mean, it's probably night and day from, you've been to Churchill, you've been up there, so it's probably night and day from that lifestyle to the lifestyle way up north. What was the biggest thing that was an eye-opener for you personally? Putting you on the spot, but...
Yeah, you are. There's so many things in different ways. So I think as far as the culture is how connected Inuit are to their culture.
Mm-hmm.
It is so strong, and it's amazing to see. I never even realized that I knew absolutely nothing about Inuit.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. Really? So we're talking about truth and reconciliation, and being from Manitoba, I knew, like your First Nation, you have your three, as far as the government of Canada goes, we group it into three types of First People. So you have Inuit, your Métis, and Aboriginal. And from Manitoba, you know a lot about Aboriginal and Métis culture and people, but I knew absolutely nothing about the Inuit. And pretty much just a stereotypical, like, oh, igloos, dog sleds, kayaks, hunting. That's literally all I knew. So it was amazing to see the people. They're like, this is my jacket I made, or these are my mitts I made, these are my mukluks I made.
Yeah.
And that's the norm.
Yeah.
So they make a lot of their clothing, they eat a lot of country food. So when they talk about basically anything that you hunt or gather, they call it, it's called country food.
Okay.
And so how much they rely on country food, which is amazing. I had no idea about everything that happened previously with, like, the Inuit are nomadic people, and so they move based on where whatever they're hunting or fishing is.
Right.
And it never occurred to me, okay, but they live in communities now, and it never occurred to me how that happened.
Right.
So that was something that my eyes got open to, and all of just those different factors that play into their life and their culture now, and how they have all of these different dialects and all of these languages that are so strong. My roommate was from Nunavik, and I communicated with her in English, but English wasn't her main language.
Right.
And that seemed really weird to me. I sound super ignorant here, but that seemed really weird to me that, like, English or French wasn't your main language and you didn't recently immigrate here.
Right.
Inuktitut was the main language that tons of people were speaking, and I thought that was really, really cool, because here when I'm out in the community and I see Aboriginal people, they're speaking in English with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not speaking in whatever their native tongue is, out in public at least, but all of these people were super embracing their language, and I thought that was absolutely amazing, and teaching people that didn't know what their language was.
Mm-hmm.
So they were doing lessons on that, and it was really, really cool.
Yeah, for sure. And like both the, like that part of the education thing, you being a teacher is like your back and that's your career. Did you happen to find out how they teach there? Like, do they kind of teach the same things we do here? Do they teach more traditional lifestyle at their schools? Like, what did you see any difference there? Did you even get to experience that?
Well, there were, so I was part of the Teachers on Ice program. So there were five of us, more from Southern Canada. And mm-hmm. then there were also five teachers that were part of a program that they're doing. I don't know how long it's been going, but the program is based on the fact that they want local people teaching their children. And so they do it a little differently. Like, for me to get my teaching certificate, I had to go and get an undergrad degree, and then I had to go and get my 2 years of my teaching degree, and then I was a certified teacher in Manitoba. Mm-hmm. They're doing it. The girl I was rooming with, she had been teaching for 5 years, but she didn't have her teaching certificate yet.
Okay.
So they kind of, she was working with another teacher that was also on the trip, and they're teaching as they're learning. So they've been doing this for, it could take years. It could take up to 10 years before they're technically certified, but they're doing courses throughout, and this was one of the courses that they were doing.
Right.
But luckily, because of that program, we had one of the ladies that worked in admin in one of the school divisions, and she was sharing with me that just some of the differences. So one of the things is they get phone calls, okay, it's the geese are here, so some of the kids aren't going to be in school, mm-hmm. and that's okay.
Yeah.
They just stop school. Or she said they go on the announcements and says, Johnny just shot a whale. Everybody get to the beach. And so they all go to the beach and share. And yeah. it's super cool. Like that would never, nobody would go on the PA at yeah. my school and be like, so-and-so just shot a deer. Let's go.
Yeah.
that just doesn't happen.
Right.
That's just a great example of like the difference in the ways of lives between us and them. And I think one thing that always stuck out to me was like, when I traveled up north into these smaller communities, these isolated communities, you get to see what these people value and how different that is from you. Because, I mean, right. we're almost stuck in this rat race down here of, you know, when am I going to get a new truck? How big is my house going to be?
Yeah.
When am I going to get my next new toy or whatever it may be?
What am I saving up for?
Yeah. And then you get up there and, like, not... like these people, they don't have a lot, like material wise compared to people in the South, we'll say.
Yeah.
But you look at how happy they are with what they have, and like the stuff that they do is very interesting. And it's like, it's crazy to think that sometimes the stuff that we actually care about down here, and it just really does not matter.
Well, that's just it too. Like you basically, I think nailed it. Like I've only been up to, like I said, Churchill, Rankin, blah, blah, blah. But I've hunted up there, and it's a total different perspective on life. Like, if I walk to work, I could walk by 15 different plants or trees and not even acknowledge what they are. I just see them every day, you know? But I know what kind of pizzas they have at Pizza Hut. Do you know what I mean? So, like, the things yeah. that I'm remembering, or what kind of car that was or whatever,
yeah.
it's totally different from the way of life up north, because they're looking at flowers, trees, whatever they can do to make their life better with what the earth has to offer.
Yeah.
So, like, they know what kind of bird that was. They know what kind of flower that was. And all these things that they're gathering throughout their life compared to, like us, when we're like thinking about, oh, what does the new truck look like, you know,
yeah.
and trying to remember those stats to talk about them rather than what's actually happening around us.
Yeah.
And that's one of the biggest things that I've noticed going up to the north every once in a while is that just people are more involved in their surroundings and knowing yeah. what is.
They're more connected to the land for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The connected to the land part is something that was very evident. I went to one session and it was, I can't remember the name of it, but the gist of it was that how to have conservation using traditional stories. And how do those go together? Like, how do we mesh all of the traditional knowledge with science? Because sometimes they seem to butt heads.
Yeah.
And it was amazing, some of the stories and some of the work that they had done. That session was put on by Val Couture, who's a forester, and she has an amazing amount of knowledge. And one of the stories that she said, I'm not gonna try and explain it because I don't think I would do it justice, but it was about a man who married a caribou. And like, this isn't like not a traditional marriage, like
yeah.
but it was trying to talk to the interconnectedness between the people and the land, and how the caribou watcher, if people aren't respecting it, will take all the caribou away. Or if a caribou is offered to you and you don't take it, that's actually disrespecting the caribou watcher.
Right.
And so that connectedness that they feel, and the fact that they feel they have to respect and make sure that they're doing everything that they can to use every part. And I think that if everybody acted in a way that respected the land, I don't think we would have some of the issues that we have today.
Yeah, some of the big problems. Yeah. For sure.
I agree with that.
There's actually a story about, I think it's an Inuit story about how when they would harvest an animal, they would take the head of, like, this is way back in the day, they would take the head and bring it into their home. And it was to the point where they thought that if they had, let's just say whatever it was, a walrus, or what, I don't know, whatever, some kind of animal, they'd take the head and they'd bring it into their home because they thought that after the spirit of that animal left, it would go around and say, you know, if you're going to die or you're going to get killed by somebody, let it be this family because they're good. They took everything they needed off me, blah, blah, blah. Don't worry about it. And that's like, that was a story that I don't know if I read it or heard it.
I've heard that one also.
Yeah, so that's what they used to do, right? So their like connection with spiritual and animals and everything else is evident, and it's still there, obviously, like you're saying. It's still something they teach and have in their communities, right? But I guess, we could talk, I guess, for hours about this trip that you went on, but I think we kind of nailed the climate change topic that we wanted to talk about. Is there anything else that you wanted to add or talk about before we start wrapping things up?
I think all I could say would be just to try and do the best that you can to make sure that you are, like we just talked about, respecting the land in whatever way. So make sure that you're trying to get everything, if you're hunting or fishing, respecting that animal and taking everything off of it that you can and using it in every way. And just trying to minimize our impact on the earth in whatever way you can. Like, think about how much energy goes into everything that you use or consume and try and reduce that. Mm-hmm. And there's tons of, we have the internet now. So anything that you have that's a question, like any questions that you have about anything is super easy to research before you, to allow you to make an informed decision on anything. And I think if we were all a little bit more informed, we would see how important it is to listen to the message that the Inuit are trying to say and have been saying for way more years than any scientist has. They have seen climate change coming for way longer than scientists have. Right. And we just need to make sure that we're opening our ears and valuing the knowledge that's being shared.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's great.
Do you have anything else to say there, Chase?
Not really. I don't know. That was a great point there, but same kind of thing. I don't know. Just think about the future and where it's going to be. Often when I try to relate to stuff, you know, think about where my son's going to be in 20 years, when he's 30 years old, what's the world going to look like? And lots of stuff that I want him to experience is going to be, could be gone because we're just
ignorant.
Yeah. Not taking good care of this place. So, so that's something to think about and that I kind of try and relate to. So,
yeah, for sure. I think my final thoughts are, doing this podcast with you is kind of something I've been looking forward to, just to kind of hear your opinion and voice behind your trip and like what you learned and about the North and everything else, because I think it's people like us that gotta spread the word and just talk about it and make it open in the air about how things are happening up there, right? Like we've talked earlier, like you said, you had no idea about their culture until you went up there and saw it. And I think the voice behind that on your part is a huge stepping stone in the right direction for that topic, right?
Yeah.
Especially climate change.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for coming and
thanks a lot for having us in your home.
Yeah, I guess having us, doing the podcast. If anybody want to look up more information, do you have some websites and stuff that you can give to us and we can put it on to our social media and stuff?
Yeah, for sure. One of the easiest ones would be just the Students on Ice Foundation that does this expedition every year.
Okay.
I'll definitely get that to you guys. And one of the great things about this trip was that I have access to all of the experts that were on the ship. And so that's a amazing amount of knowledge and connections that I was able to accumulate because of that.
Yeah.
That's definitely to value that experience that you were able to do that. I don't even know where you put that, but that's awesome.
Yeah.
And for us, we will obviously this podcast will be aired and we're going to try to share it in a way that it'll be more information and you know, just getting the word out for that Student on Ice Foundation. And, you know, the more people that know about stuff like this, it's going to benefit, I think. So, but yeah, thanks a lot for having us here doing the podcast. And anybody that's listening, check this stuff out. Check out these websites. We'll have links. Thanks for following us on Instagram. Thanks for following our podcast. Thanks for rating us. And if you haven't yet, rate us. Let us know how we're doing. Send us an email or something. And I think that's about it.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, guys.
Right on.